On today's episode of Baseball Barbacast, we welcome Dodgers writer Katie Wu over at The Athletic to talk about all things weird and concerning with the back-to-back defending champs. Edwin Diaz back on the IL. Kyle Tucker needs a vacation. We chat about this super bizarre Ketel Marte situation. Where is he? We hope he's okay. It's just really weird, man. And the Mariners lost 22-0. Here we go. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world. Having frustrations performing in front of a home crowd, I'm Jake Mintz. That's Katie Wu of The Athletic. Dodgers writer Jordan remains on vacation for one more show. And in his stead, our third pinch hitter, a woman of great renown, a woman of many words, a woman who is always down to grab a cold one after a ball game. Katie Wu, welcome to the program.
So third pinch hitter means I'm like quite literally 26th man on the roster, but I'll take it. You know, everyone has value on an active roster, allegedly. So I'll take it.
Katie, the other way to think about it is that you're hitting third. And the best hitter hits third, unless you're Chandler Simpson on the Tampa Bay Rays, who continues to hit third for some godforsaken reason. On today's show, we're going to talk about, obviously, the Los Angeles Dodgers, the team that Katie spends her life, or her work life, just her work-life balance is important, just her work life, following around and writing words about. We'll talk about Ketel Marte going AWOL, and then a number of other topics, but let us begin in Los Angeles. The Los Angeles Dodgers are in a weird place. No, not Coors Field, although that is indeed a very weird place. LA is coming off of two of the least inspiring wins I can remember. Games that they only won because they were playing the Rockies. Edwin Diaz is back on the IL. Kyle Tucker is not crying, all truth or that, but is certainly not having a wonderful time. The two-time defending champs are doing their annual late summer lull, and it is the period of the year where we can all pretend like everything is wrong, and then they'll win the World Series in 3 months. And who better to talk about this than Katie Wu? Katie, let's begin with Edwin Diaz, who went on the IL yesterday. My question for you is, what percentage of this IL stint is physical injury, and what percentage of this is we need to send this guy somewhere far away from a Major League Baseball field?
I think, it's definitely, if we're going to shift percentages, more of the second. I'm not in Denver this series, but Dave Roberts told reporters in Denver they expect Edwin Diaz to come back this season. Talking to people behind the scenes, it doesn't seem serious. It's neck inflammation, something upper body. So anytime a team is so vague with an injury, you're like, okay. Yeah. They just want to get their hands on this guy and get him right. And can you blame them? I mean, Edwin Diaz has been essentially unusable in the ninth since coming back from that elbow surgery at the end of July. The Dodgers, though, because of their big lead in the division and their overall mentality of we're going to need him in October, so he needs to get right in August, kept using him. I mean, when have you seen a closer being brought in up nine on the road? And it wasn't like that outing was a super convincing one by any means. It was very nerve-wracking. I didn't like it. But I think something kind of pinged to me that something was off with Edwin Diaz. His final fastball of that outing bottomed out at 93. So clearly something not all the way right physically. Dodgers feel like they've spotted something with his arm angle. It's dropped dramatically from 19% to 15% dating back to last year. Could that be attributed to some of that upper body stiffness, soreness? Maybe the bigger thing, obviously, Mr. Jake Mintz, get Edwin Diaz right. You're paying him $69 million to have a double-digit ERA. It has not been good.
Yeah, that is a bad investment. We have talked on the show about something I call the Cancun Clause, where each year one player on each team can just go spend 2 weeks on the beach. I think that the rigors of an MLB season are exhausting. And yes, these people are making lots of money and they have nice sweatsuits and they have nice planes. But, you know, they get exhausted sometimes. And we see it with Edwin Diaz and we see it really with Kyle Tucker, where the pressure of it all seems to be getting to them. Katie, maybe the neck injury for Edwin Diaz is all the times he's had to hang his head over the last couple of weeks.
or like the whiplash of balls leaving the bat. Oh, yeah. I don't know. It's some loud, loud contact.
Here's a question. So Tanner Scott is a very interesting character in all this. And so the Dodgers give him a bucket of money last winter. And he is sort of seen as this turning point in anti-Dodger anger, where the money spent on Tanner Scott sort of represented the Dodgers going above and beyond to go and get any player they want. Tanner Scott has a very disastrous first season. He ends up not really being on the playoff rosters, not on the World Series roster at the very least. Comes back in 2026 and has been really good. He has been one of the most reliable, if not the most reliable Dodgers reliever. Edwin Diaz comes back off the IL, bumps Tanner Scott out of the ninth, sucks up the farm. Now Diaz is going back on the shelf, and they're just going to ask Tanner Scott to carry the ninth inning again, as they did last night. What is your sense of how Tanner Scott sort of fits into all this stuff?
I mean, they're in big trouble without Tanner Scott. And that's funny, because around this time last year, if I would have said that, I think Dodgers fans would have been like, someone please get her checked out, she's ill. But when you think about Edwin Diaz, I mean, the Dodgers were so adamant over the offseason that they really only needed two things. They had two concerns, the ninth inning and their outfield production. So they go and they spend over $300 million combined to make sure they don't have those issues. You could actually argue those issues have now been made worse by these acquisitions. So Tanner Scott coming in and figuring it out, I mean, he's a guy that can do an up down. He can throw multiples if needed. He can go in there and shut the door on the ninth. That's a 17th save yesterday that he picked up. It's interesting, because when Diaz was struggling, Dave Roberts went out there and kind of caught like a lot of ire from people like us saying, I don't have any other options with Edwin Diaz struggling. Well, you do. It's Tanner Scott. You used him plenty. But I think what he was trying to say is, because the Dodgers bullpen is so thin, keep in mind they only have seven guys right now because Shohei Ohtani has no two-way status. So he's been trying to keep Tanner Scott in that setup role to get Diaz there. Now it's Tanner Scott and just get whatever kind of win or save situation you can. It was four outs yesterday. It's going to be the ninth going forward. It's just kind of, I didn't expect the Dodgers to have a mess in their bullpen. And what's, I think, annoying for fans, 29 other fan bases, is that their bullpen is a problem, but you can easily sit here and say it won't be in October, because they have the ability to kind of restructure guys out of their rotation right now. You only need four starters in the postseason. The Dodgers have an entire staff of aces. So if Edwin Diaz still isn't right, what can you do? Oh, Roky Sasaki, come on down, you know?
And it has been bad, but the team ERA in the bullpen over the full season is 4.02. which is exactly middle of the pack. It is 14th out of 30 teams. That's not dominant. And for what they're paying for that bullpen, it should obviously be better. But it's not as if the Dodgers have this catastrophic Swiss cheese unit back there. Like, they have been at times reliable relative to the league. And I do think you make a really important point, is that the bullpen that exists right now is not the bullpen that will exist come October. And if there's one thing that is important to understand about these Los Angeles Dodgers, it's that they treat the regular season like it's spring training, right? Other teams need to treat the regular season like it's October in order to actually get to the playoffs. The Dodgers can afford to slow play guys. They can afford to mix and match. They can afford to, you know, take their time with problems. The Dodgers currently have 10 dudes on the roster that have gotten a save, which is kind of a remarkable figure considering, you know, they signed Edwin Diaz and they already had Tanner Scott. Let's pivot now to Kyle Tucker, who really has become this emblem for schadenfreude, for taking joy in others' misfortune. Tucker, when he joined the Dodgers over the winter for $60 million, represented more than Tanner Scott a year ago, sort of the Los Angeles opulence that was taking place. He has been thoroughly disappointing. He is a 94 OPS plus. He has 11 home runs on the year. His OPS starts with a 6. Over the last week, he went 0 for the homestand in LA, got benched because he wasn't having fun playing at home, dropped a fly ball on Monday night at Coors Field, did have an RBI double against the Rockies last night. Where do things stand with Kyle Tucker? What does the path look like between where we are now, where this guy is playing with no confidence, to October to get him right over these last 6 weeks?
I mean, the biggest thing is that Kyle Tucker can avoid the Y word, which is the yips. And when you see him, especially defensively, start to have those mental mistakes come in because of what I'm assuming is the lack of confidence at the plate. I mean, 0 for 19 on the homestand. And it was a big homestand. They had four games against the Brewers. And he went 0 for 19. Dave Roberts probably made a good decision sitting him on Saturday, considering the Dodgers were facing Jacob Mizorowski. Even your best hitter doesn't want to face Mizorowski. Kyle Tucker certainly does not right now. And I think the big point that I'll remember from that homestand was it's the ninth inning. Dodgers are down a couple runs, but they still have a chance. Fly ball to the track. Kyle Tucker just drops it and jogs after the ball. It's a perceived lack of hustle, right? That leads to eventually two more runs scoring, puts the ball game definitively away. Fast forward to Coors Field, tough place to play, but like you have to make those plays. Easy fly ball, doesn't look good. Baby giraffe kind of legs, kind of shaky. You don't feel good about it. He drops the ball and you're like, oh gosh, this is just, he is not right. This is the worst season Kyle Tucker has had in his career. He's hitting under 200 at Dodger Stadium on the season, has some of the worst home road splits in all of baseball. But because of the point that you make, Jake, it's they have the ability to keep running him out there and make sure he gets right, because this is kind of there, with all due respect to the regular season, extended spring training. If we come September and we don't see Kyle Tucker kind of turning it around, I don't want to suggest he's unplayable, because the money certainly is going to factor into that playing time decision. But when the Dodgers are going to put their best nine on the field, especially offensively, I don't see Kyle Tucker fitting in right now, certainly not at home. And that's a big decision that I don't think the Dodgers are going to take lightly.
Why do you think the solution, or the strategy rather, for Diaz is to get him off the field and send him to Arizona, where the strategy for Tucker is the only way through is to continue rolling him out there? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, those are two different approaches for two different people, and I'm curious how you would compare and contrast them.
It's a great question. I think some of it has to do with personality and makeup. Edwin Diaz, give him his credit for as bad as he's been on the mound, has been at his locker every single post game. I mean, we don't even have to ask for him. He's there ready to talk about it. And he said, it actually made me laugh. I thanked him the other day and he goes, yeah, I learned in New York, you got to be here. So nice for the New York media. My job easier. Thank you so much. Kyle Tucker, you know, when asked, he's around, but we don't really see him other than that. And a lot of that is by design. Guys don't hang out in the clubhouse when the media is around. You know this. But there's also kind of the element where you can't hide your closer. If your closer is struggling and you bring him in the ninth, more often than not, that's going to decide the ballgame, not in your favor. You can hide one of your best hitters struggling an 0 for 4 day in the lineup continuously. You can have hitters kind of work through slumps and play the matchups to put them in the best possible situation to find success. Closers don't have that luxury. The bigger problem, I think, with doing this right now is that it's not like the Dodgers have been hitting the cover off the ball collectively, minus like Freddie Freeman, Max Muncy. They've had a pretty shoddy offense over the last month. So again, it's not a perfect situation on how to figure out where to get Kyle Tucker the most playing time, but that's just where they're at.
But like, yeah, you know, Monday night's the perfect example. The Dodgers score 11 runs. Kyle Tucker goes 0 for 5, right? And we see this happening a lot with top prospects that maybe struggle, where player development people say the only way for them to figure out how to hit big league pitching is to face big league pitching. And I do think there is an element of that at play with Kyle Tucker. What I want to ask about next is just how his personality, how his comportment is kind of fit into larger Dodger land. Last year in Chicago, there were a lot of rumblings about how he would kind of employ a more hands-off pregame strategy. He didn't really work with a lot of the hitting coaches. He didn't take a lot of pregame swings, kind of the anti-Alex Bregman, where he was saving his bullets for the game. He has always had sort of a low energy vibe to him, where doesn't really look like he's enjoying himself. That energy this year in LA has looked more like detachment, I think, than anything else. How have the guys on the team, in your understanding, either one, rallied around Kyle Tucker, attempted to bring him into this larger world? Because on one hand, yes, he has the $60 million backpack that is weighing him down. But on the other hand, like, he can just hide in a forest of superstars.
And that's kind of why we all thought collectively as an industry that this was the perfect place for him, because he can hide behind, you know, a Freddie Freeman, a Mookie Betts, a Shohei Ohtani, take your pick. And it's been interesting because this is a Dodgers team that really values their preparation for a back-to-back roster full of superstars. No one really takes pregame work off or days off. I mean, Freddie Freeman fell down the stairs headfirst and was in the lineup the next day. They take their work very seriously. And I'm not saying that you have to be out there taking batting practice every day, extra reps on the infield, shagging fly balls. Like, a lot of those guys don't necessarily do the on-field stuff. Kyle Tucker certainly does not. But working behind the scenes, you know, I don't think it's fair to say that this guy doesn't care. I mean, if his overall attitude is, or personality is kind of low level, low energy, you know, not everyone can be Kike Hernandez, and that's okay. I don't think anyone's asking Kyle Tucker to be something that he's not. But when you're looking at how he fits in with the guys, I think they all understand. They're all pros. Like, this is someone that has their routine and it works for them. You know, his locker's right next to Miggy Rowe, who is kind of like the clubhouse dad. I think the Dodgers really only care if it starts to impact your performance on the field. And I don't think Kyle Tucker's performance on the field has anything to do with what he's doing pregame. I think at this point, it's all mentally. We are a middle of August. What you have on your stats is who you are this season. And Kyle Tucker is certainly feeling the weight of that $60 million backpack at this point.
I do think the preparation stuff is relevant in the larger story of who Kyle Tucker is and what he will be as he moves forward, where earlier in his career, he was young enough and athletic enough and talented enough where he could kind of save his bullets for the game. And that is, in my understanding, like an intentional approach. That is not him being lazy. That is like how he found success. But as you age and you lose some of the physical gifts, you have to find other ways to succeed. And that usually does come with preparation, with approach. We have seen that with Freddie Freeman, right? He is not as powerful as he used to be. He is almost as good because of how he works before the game, how he approaches his at-bats. And I had skepticism last winter of Tucker being able to do that, and we are sort of seeing that come to fruition. Katie, we have 6 weeks left in the season. If the Dodgers do not make the playoffs, it would be flooring. Like, they're making the playoffs, like, duh. Whether or not they get the two or the three seed, or even the one seed at this point, is an open question. If it all goes wrong, if they lose in October, why? Like, let's just imagine that is the end of the story. And it is still a very large possibility. In fact, I'd say it is the most likely possibility, considering the randomness of our sport. But if it does go sideways, why will it have gone sideways?
I think age and fatigue, really. And it sounds like a cop-out, but look at this roster. I mean, every team is going to go through, okay, your bullpen's not great, or your hitters went cold at the right time. Like, the typical, this is what happens in the postseason. The hottest team usually advances the farthest. But this team is tired. And they aren't the youngest roster in the league by far. It's why they're putting such an emphasis on getting the first round bye. It's why dropping 3 or 4 to Milwaukee over the weekend and losing the season series felt like such a heavy impact. Because I'm not sure with this team and their age and just how many games they've played dating back to 2024 that they can get through a first round bye and still have all of their energy to get through what they need to be as a their third straight World Series. I know the argument is they did it last year, so what? It was taxing. It took a lot out of them. I saw them come out of the break in the second half. We had 10 games on the East Coast. They were still feeling that a week later. Guys were like, hey, we're not going to make excuses, but we're kind of gassed right now. So age and fatigue is legit.
Lord knows you and I were gassed. We were gassed after that stretch.
I was not okay. I was crawling onto my flight, essentially, leaving New York. So I get it. And I do think, like, when you look at the overall offensive plights of guys like Mookie Betts, Teoscar Hernandez, age is definitely playing into it.
Yeah. So there are two everyday players under the age of 30. That's Pajes and that's Tucker, who's 29. Has he turned 30 yet? He turns 30 in January. So, like, two everyday players under the age of 30 is pretty striking. Now, one of the other main characters in the National League, the Philadelphia Phillies, are built in a relatively similar way with a lot of older players. But the Dodgers, having played into October, deep in October, the last two seasons, there is a chance that all of that baseball sort of adds up and gets to them. My last roster related question, and then we'll take a break, just has to do with the rotation. There are so many question marks about who exactly will be starting these games. Chances are Cy Young vote recipients will be starting these games. If you had to like handicap it right now, who are the four human beings that start playoff games in the NLDS for the Los Angeles Dodgers?
Okay, in no particular order, we're going to go Yama, obviously. Can't have your 25 so wait, World Series.
Let me hop in here. If they can line it up, who gets game one? Yamamoto or Scooble?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think out of respect to Yamamoto, Yamamoto is game one, followed by Scooble, followed by Snell, followed by Ohtani as your opener for Tyler Glasnow, because they need Ohtani's two-way status. They're just a completely different team, obviously, with 14 pitchers compared to 13. So that's the most likely no surprises. So
they would then call Ohtani a two-way player. It gives them an extra pitcher. Chances are at this point, he's not going to be built back up enough to throw deep into a ball game. But if they start him on the mound, they get the two-way status. He throws to the top of the other team's order, throws like 50 sweepers or whatever, and then they bring in Tyler Glasnow. So do you think go ahead.
Like, think Tyler Glasnow needs an opener? That's crazy.
It's ridiculous. But again, like, Tyler Glasnow has thrown 39 innings this year. This is not someone that he was so dynamite in October last year, and I think quieted a lot of critiques about his, call it, on-mound toughness or ability to post or whatever. Like, he shut that up last year. Now he's gone back this year onto the shelf and has really not been around, but he's trending back. I believe he's already had a couple of rehab outings in the minor leagues, and he's on plan to be a character in October. Now, these things can change, but I think at the end of the day, the Dodgers can roll this rotation out, and as we saw in the NLCS last year, dominate offenses, and that is how they win the World Series, if they do indeed win it. Katie Wu, let's take a break. And when we get back, we will talk about the last baseball team to beat the Dodgers in a postseason series, the Arizona Diamondbacks, and their AWOL also. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Ketel Marte. I do not have him on Find My Friends, and it appears that the Arizona Diamondbacks do not have him either. Okay, Katie, this is weird, this story. It is tinged with this undercurrent of human concern that is relevant, but given Marte's track record, the benefit of the doubt is difficult to hold on to. We will go through the beat by beat of this and get everyone caught up. Ketel Marte, one of the best hitters when he's right in the National League, a three-time All-Star, the NLCS MVP in 2023, two-time Silver Slugger, currently having something of a down year, but for him, a down year is still being an above-average hitter. He is 32 years old, signed a five-year extension with the Diamondbacks, I believe, the beginning of last season. And nothing seemed particularly amiss. That is until on Monday afternoon, when we heard via multiple Diamondbacks reporters that Marte was not at the yard. He had traveled to Boston with the team after a weekend spent in Atlanta, posted a photo on his Instagram story out the plane window of him landing in Boston, which, always good to let people know where you are. He did not do that on Monday. He did not show up to the yard. For whatever reason, as of recording, we do not know. It is unclear what that specific reason is. He goes on the restricted list about an hour, a half hour before first pitch. The Diamondbacks were still holding out hope that he would show up kind of closer and closer to game time. After that loss, a blowout loss to the Red Sox, manager Torey Lovello was very vague, saying, this is a quote, "I'm still hoping he's okay. Looking forward to having a connection with him at some point as soon as possible. Overall, I feel like if you don't show up to work, something is on your mind and something's not right, and we've got to get it right." There were reports of him being seen kind of in the lobby at the hotel bar on Monday night with other Diamondbacks people. We now know he's flying back to Arizona to get an MRI on his knee. Katie Wu, in your years of covering the ball, have you ever had player not showing up to the stadium to sort of deal with and cover and write about?
Certainly not one that the team was planning to have and was going to be their DH that day. It's certainly not one that flew with the team. And, you know, I don't want to sound callous here, Jake, but when the reports first came out that the Diamondbacks were replacing Martin on the restricted list, I thought that was really weird because if you remember, Nolan Arenado the night before said he was pretty concerned about an intercostal muscle strain that he might have had. So I was like, this is not good, because I think that the D-backs were still searching for answers on Arenado. They hadn't released the lineup yet. But I also wasn't surprised, because with Marte, the history has been like, we don't really know what's going on. Sometimes he'll just leave. Well, you know, he just was absent last year when his home was broken into. But I think he wasn't even in Arizona at the time. I think he was in the DR. So I wasn't surprised. If one name on the D-backs is going to pop up of on the restricted list randomly an hour before the game, it was Marte. But the rest of this has been
Right. That is a really good point. And I think that what's difficult about this conversation, obviously, is when you see a guy go on the restricted list, there are really like three categories of things. And it's like dangerous to hypothesize. One is that the person is not okay. Like, they are having a problem and that problem needs to be rectified. Two is crime, that they committed some sort of illegality or malfeasance or broke a rule, whether a team rule or a, you know, national law. And then the third thing is what I would call, you know, everything else, mystery box, the dude didn't feel like showing up today category. And I think that based upon what we have gathered from the reporting of people that cover the Diamondbacks, is that Ketel Marte is not in a life-threatening situation, and that Ketel Marte did not commit a crime. I am not 1,000% sure. No one around the team has said that like that assertively, but it does seem like those two things are understandable. And so then you go to this place where it's like, I hope this person mentally is all right. But when you look on his history, as you mentioned, in 2025, there were people around the team that were frustrated with a lack of commitment. He went on the restricted list after the break last year. There was the break-in at his house in Arizona. Turns out he was actually in the Dominican Republic at the time. That stuff seemed to have improved throughout this season, based upon my understanding. And so for this to just happen out of nowhere is really confusing and perplexing, and just shrouds the whole thing in a thunderstorm of mystery.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, it goes without saying, you hope that whatever Ketel Marte is going through, that he is okay, that mentally he's in a place, you know, where he's going to be all right. And I think if you're the D-backs, you're thinking, hey, that's going to be our first priority, but also we need this guy to get right. This comes at a time where the D-backs are very much in contention for the National League wild card, and they need this guy to compete. And I think there could be some frustration growing. You know, it's not like there haven't been issues about him showing up in the past, as you went through. For someone where this continues to happen, I think it's natural, especially on the outside, to be like, okay, here we go again with Ketel Marte. But the bigger thing is, besides the fact that you hope he's okay and there's nothing more serious, especially mentally, going on, it's, can he be dependable for this squad that needs him down the stretch run? And what can the Diamondbacks do? Because he's a key member. And yeah, I know they talked about trading him, and, you know, there are reasons why they didn't and why they kept on to him. But this is certainly not something anyone in the Diamondbacks maybe was thinking could happen. At this point, though, do you have to start keeping that in the back of your mind that, hey, this guy could go just leave at any point?
So it doesn't matter, though. Like, he's got 10-5 rights, right? So 10 years in the show, 5 on a single team, he can nix any trade. And so even if you did find a home for him, he would have to agree to that. We do have a little update here. This was about a half hour ago. Ketel Marte's agent, Charisse Espinoza Dash, just a phenomenal name, shared the following update with John Morosi. Quote, he is currently managing a personal matter and will be undergoing an MRI on his knee tomorrow. Ketel appreciates the unwavering support from fans, teammates, the Diamondbacks organization. This is a great non-update. I didn't learn anything here, really. We know there's a personal matter. We know there's an MRI on the knee. Are those two things related? We also don't know that. I want to focus on the thing we do know, which is the last part of this. The support from the Diamondbacks organization. The team has been so like adamant about being behind Cattell throughout this entire period. When he was there, when the report came out last year that there were people around that weren't happy with how he was carrying himself, asking for days off, ducking good pitchers, whatever. Like Gerardo Perdomo hopped in and was very complimentary of Cattell and very passionate about his about supporting his teammate. And I think the way that Lovello has played this with a combination of one, emotional openness, and two, factual obfuscation or vagueness is very interesting to me because it says that they understand the most optimal path forward is to have Cattell Marte happy, healthy, and playing baseball games for the Arizona Diamondbacks. No matter what happened, it appears that the organization, whether they have all the details or not, is willing to move forward, even still, to ensure that Cattell Marte is a part of this team. And he is under contract for another 4 years. And so it makes sense that they would take care to kind of welcome him back with open arms whenever he's ready. My question to you is, if you're a dude in that room, if you're a player in that clubhouse, it's such a bizarre combination of concern and frustration, I would imagine.
Yeah, agreed. And talking to a few guys in that clubhouse, I think it's one thing if this has never happened before and you have a guy that flew with you on the team charter to Boston, all of a sudden doesn't show up. You're like, okay, this is weird. This is strange. I really hope something's, you know, something's obviously wrong. So I hope he's okay. But because this is, you know, he kind of has a propensity of doing this, I think it does become more of the frustration of like, okay, he's gone again. At what point can we rely on him to be with the one of the 26 guys going forward? Again, the D-backs very firmly in playoff contention right now. And you make a good point. There have been a lot of people coming to his defense. Your teammates don't stick up for you publicly and willingly talk to the media about you unless they care very strongly about you and think the treatment has been unfair or something along those lines. But at this point, you know, if especially with, I mean, shout out Torrey Lovello, who's had to really have a tough job answering all these questions without stumping on company lines from his bosses, while also, you know, trying to give the reporters there and the fans answers they feel they deserve. So it's just kind of a mess. And inside the clubhouse, I think there's a combination exactly of we hope he's okay, but also, dude, show up to work.
Yeah, I'm here. Jake Mintz is here. Katie Wu is here. I think Cattell Marte is someone who has acquired doubts about his willingness to be committed to his job. I do want to give Torrey Lovello the flowers, though. This is a guy on the hot seat. I don't know if that's fair. Yes, the Diamondbacks have not made the playoffs each of the last two seasons, but he and Mike Hazen, the general manager, just they do a very good job of treating people well. They have a strong reputation of carrying themselves in the right way. And I'm curious, like, is there a situation here where, okay, let me ask you this. Do you think like Torrey has all the facts, or maybe the team is being like, we are not going to tell you everything so that you can go out and talk to the media and not lie through your teeth about what's going on. You know what I mean? Like there's sort of this like deniability that exists here, maybe.
You know, some front office manager dynamics, I absolutely see that. Sometimes it's just easier, I think, for front office to maybe protect their manager. I actually don't think the front office knows entirely what's going on either. I think the Diamondbacks collectively are really just kind of hung out to dry. I haven't worked with Mike Hazen directly, but I've heard good things in terms about the communicator and the leader that he is. And you can just tell with the way that Torrey Lovello's answered questions to media that he is trying his best to give them something, but I don't think he really knows 100% what's going on. And I don't think the Diamondbacks collectively do either. Certainly, they're probably, they know a little bit more than they're letting on publicly out of protection of their player and the organization. That's just how this works. But I mean, the beat writers out there, Steve Gilbert, Nick Pecora, like working their butts off to try and get more information. Torrey doesn't strike me as a guy that really has all that more to give. And I don't think that's intentional from the front office.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I do think you're right. Nick Pecora and Steve Gilbert have been on this beat for a long time. The idea that they have not yet been able to figure out the specifics of what's going on tells us that this is that information has not made its way to the team yet. That would be my read on it because those two are very plugged in that market. Hopefully Cattell gets everything sorted out. Hopefully he's back on the field at some point this season. this whole fiasco does seem to have been weighing on the D-backs, who laid two consecutive eggs at Fenway Park the last two nights. That series wraps up this afternoon. As of recording, Arizona is currently outside the playoff picture, two games on an L3, two games behind the San Diego Padres for that third spot, just one game ahead of the St. Louis Cardinals, who are making noise and hanging around. Katie Wu, let's take a break. And when we get back, I'm going to ask you about Mark Walter and if you and I can put our money together to buy one of his sports franchises. And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. Before we get out of here, let's go around the league. If there's one thing I love more than a hot dog and a beer and a hot summer day at a ball yard, it's financial malfeasance. Katie Wu, the owner of the Los Angeles Dodgers, Mark Walter, is under the spotlight. Here's the deal. This story is so large and so complex and has so many different webs and chapters to it that it is almost not worth like getting caught in the specifics here. We are not a financial crimes podcast, at least not yet. Mark Walter, who made his money in the insurance business, is currently under federal investigation for two of his insurance companies not properly reporting some of those companies' investments in affiliated companies. The idea here is that Mark Walter owns a ton of different stuff. His businesses are loaning money and in debt to one another, which creates a conflict of interest. Katie Wu, have I done a decent enough job in layman's terms explaining the specific misdealings that are alleged here?
Much better than I would have. I mean, this is kind of directly impacting, or could directly impact, my job, and I'm still reading at like a third grade level on how to figure out all these legal terms. So nice work.
And this man's got like 85 different companies. There was a good article at your website today at The Athletic. Amid federal scrutiny, Dodgers owner Mark Walter's empire shifting billions. You know when you wake up in the morning, Katie, and you just feel like shifting some billions? Can't relate. Mark Walter, just a Tuesday where I'm shifting billions. Mark Walter, over the last like week and a half, has offloaded the Los Angeles Lakers, a team that he bought 14 months ago. I believe he bought them for around $10 billion and he's selling them for around $12 billion, and is reportedly in talks to sell his stake in Chelsea Football Club. Get in, Chelsea. And so what we have here is a man that needs liquidity to pay off some debts. There was a quote in this article at The Athletic from a sort of financial crimes expert, not us. Quote, Mark Walter right now is making huge transactions at speeds that are incredibly dramatic. Through it all, you have been told, as a reporter covering the Los Angeles Dodgers, that none of this is going to impact the Dodgers in any way, that it is business as usual, that the franchise is going to continue operating as it has. One, do you believe that? Two, why should we believe that?
That's the bigger question, right? Why should we believe this? We talked to Dodgers president Stan Kasten earlier in the week, and we asked, this is the day that the Lakers story broke. And he said, this is a Lakers story. It's not really a Dodgers story. It really has nothing to do with the Dodgers. It's completely separate. There are no changes here or being contemplated here. For now, I think we can go ahead and look at all the smoke between, I don't know, smoke and mirrors, whatever the saying is, and think, like, this cannot be something where Mark Walter and the Dodgers don't come up later in terms of questioning the future and if he is still going to own Los Angeles. Right now, you know, there are much bigger things over if Mark Walter is going to stay, if he's going to sell the Dodgers. We don't even need to get into the Ohtani clause, which says, you know, I can opt out of this contract if Mark Walter leaves. The big red flag was how quickly the Lakers sale went down, because this is something that there was a lot of Lakers-Dodgers crossover. I think a lot of the Dodgers higher ups were very excited to kind of fix the Lakers the way they have fixed the Dodgers. And if all of a sudden you are cutting money to the Los Angeles Dodgers, who have known for their relentless spending, it's going to completely change the trajectory of the organization. Obviously, if they get to the point where you are contemplating selling the Dodgers, which again, there have been no indication externally that they are, everything about what we know about this franchise is going to be up in the air. I still think business as usual. Dodgers try to get through the World Series. We have a lockout pending that's going to impact all 30 teams, obviously. But this is not something where we can just say, okay, well, Dodgers said it's going to be fine, so it is. This is a thing much higher above both of our pay grades in terms of the financial ramifications and potential legal ramifications here. And I think it'd be foolish to just say the Dodgers are going to be fine.
We had some good reporting this morning from John Orand over at Puck, who reported that Mark Walter had looked into letting Charter, who owns the television rights for the Lakers and the Dodgers, basically approach Charter about Charter opting out of those deals early in exchange for a lump sum payout. That didn't end up happening. That tells us that Mark Walter, at least, is not as liquid financially as he would like to be. How the Dodgers stay sort of bubbled off from all of this is going to be one of the most interesting stories over the next 6 months as we move into the lockout. The Dodgers are a very financially good, this is a good financial operation. The Los Angeles Dodgers, even with all of the spending on payroll, they are making a lot of money. Even if the Lakers sale is not a Dodgers story, it is a Mark Walter story. And the Dodgers are a Mark Walter asset. And so I think it is foolish and short-sighted and misleading to imply that those two things cannot be related. How it ends up impacting the Dodgers is difficult to say. I would posit that the team's eagerness to go to the White House on an off day between games in Philadelphia and New York might be related to the federal investigation. Just a thought, not a bad time to go kiss the ring. It is very difficult to say how this will play out, but I do think you're right, Kitty. Like, this has to influence the Dodgers in some form or fashion.
100%. And again, this is, I just think that this is something that we don't even understand maybe the scale of what's happening to a federal level. I mean, it's one thing to talk about selling a sports team. It's another thing to talk about an FBI investigation. But this is, I think this final sentence here, not yet relevant but notable, is how I'm viewing the Dodgers part of the Mark Walter saga here. Yeah. Because right now, I haven't seen obviously any indication of that this is going to impact the Dodgers other than their overall bad play as of late. But this is something that we're going to be monitoring going into a potential lockout and the Dodgers facing, you know, who knows what the next CBA is going to look like. But I think you and I can both understand that there are going to be some sort of financial limitations at some point. And this is all going to be connected to, I think, what could be a very concerning time for an organization that for so long has felt very, very comfortable.
Maybe that's what Kyle Tucker is so distraught about.
Maybe
Kyle Tucker's like losing sleep at night, thinking about Mark Walter and all of his various business operations. And he's saying like, oh man, I was so excited to get to work with Rui Hachimura on, you know, is he still on the Lakers? No. Oh, he's on the Clippers. See, I don't follow basketball at all. Yeah, that's what Kyle Tucker is so distraught about Mark Walter and all of his alleged financial improprieties. Let's move from financial improprieties to moral ones. A Padres catching coordinator, there's a transition, was detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement on Monday, I believe, by ICE. This is a scary, scary story. Really the first major example of someone in the baseball world being detained by ICE. I believe there was an example of a player in Arizona that was on a visa and broke the law in a way and was sent home maybe last year. It was a minor leaguer. This has gotten a lot more buzz. A gentleman by the name of Oswaldo Perella, who is the minor league catching coordinator for the San Diego Padres, was detained at El Paso Airport in Texas in the wee hours of the morning on Sunday. This is from your colleague, Sam Blum. Perella is 34 years old, father of two, from Venezuela. He was not carrying his work permit card at the time that he was detained. Perella was granted permission by the Obama. This is a Department of Homeland Security statement. On August 16th, Border Patrol arrested Oswaldo Jose Perella Dominguez, an illegal alien from Venezuela, at the El Paso International Airport. He entered the country legally September 10th, 2014, and was granted permission by the Obama administration to remain in the country until February 2018. In violation of our nation's laws, he has overstayed his welcome. When approached by law enforcement officers, he was not in possession of legal documentation granting him status in the country. He will remain in ICE custody pending removal proceedings and will receive due process. So this is like the Mark Walters situation, a conversation much larger than the scope of our baseball world. But as it pertains to Major League Baseball, what is important here is this. The number of foreigners that are engaged in the baseball world, people that are not American citizens, is significant and goes beyond big league rosters. And Oswaldo Perella is a really strong example of that, whether it's minor league coaches or scouts or the family members of minor leaguers or major leaguers. There are a lot of people that are at risk of being deported as part of the baseball world. When Rob Manfred made the kind of a under the radar trip to the White House a number of years ago, which resulted in Pete Rose having his Hall of Fame status changed and reconsidered, part of the unspoken assumption there is that the Trump administration would sort of turn a blind eye to, not a blind eye necessarily, but not be as vigorous in its aggressive policies in applying it to the world of professional baseball. And really, up until this point, that has been the case. This is a departure from that. It is scary. It is concerning. This is someone who, it seems, has a work permit, but did not have it with him. If he is the catching coordinator for the San Diego Padres, that is someone who very feels like they are allowed to be in this country. Katie, there's just so much bubbling around this, but I should give you the floor to give a comment on it.
I think scary is the word I would use for this. I mean, you hit it spot on. The amount of presence for people that were maybe not American citizens is so prevalent in especially scouting lower levels of the minor leagues. I mean, we talk about all the time teams needing to invest more in Latin America players and Latin America complexes. And when you're the San Diego Padres, you are so close to Tijuana and Mexico there. It just seems like there is so much crossover. And it's a really tough situation, right? If having, you know, the fact that he, according to these reports and according to the statement, did not have his work papers just really complicates what is already a scary situation. But the moral of the story is here is every single baseball team, all 30 MLB organizations, have players or have staff members like this that are working for their professional organizations and have to travel between Latin America or in the United States or pick your country to do their jobs. And this is just a really scary situation where you hope has a resolution. I mean, it's already, I'm sure, traumatic, but hopefully going forward can minimize that trauma and just get it as soon as possible.
And we have a quote from the MLB Players Association. A significant percentage of the guys who play in the major and minor leagues are born outside the United States. We continue to support them and their families by working closely with immigration experts to make sure they have what they need to remain in the country safely and to make sure they carry proper documentation while traveling. So my guess here is that, you know, this gentleman did not have his papers on him. The idea that he even needs papers at all is a longer conversation that I don't feel like having. We had a situation last year, maybe at the beginning of the spring training, where Jung-Hoo Lee just like left all of his papers in Korea when he was coming over for spring training and got detained by ICE. That feels more like a "you goofed it, Jung-Hoo." This is a very different type of story. Speaking of a very different type of story, before we get out of here, oh my God, the Seattle Mariners lost 22-0. Katie Wu, what in the freaking world? Last night, the Milwaukee Brewers scored three touchdowns and one extra point against the woeful Seattle Mariners. It was 1-0 going into the bottom of the fifth, and it finished 22-0, 22 runs on 22 hits. The Seattle Mariners walked only five guys. Like, walking five guys and allowing 22 runs is kind of hard to do. Big days from Christian Yelich, from Jake Bowers, from Garrett Mitchell. We had a very embarrassing moment at the end of this where Julio Rodriguez, in a 19-0 game, forgot how many outs there were and threw the baseball into the stands. It is the most lopsided home shutout in 141 years. Katie, what do you remember about the last one?
So my favorite thing about baseball is, like, we see a lot of crazy things every day. We're just like, what is that? But rarely do I get to the point where I, like, audibly have a reaction. So I'm going through the scores on my phone and I'm like, 22. I mean, that just it. When I saw how a couple of the final runs had gotten across the board with Julio's little mind slip there, that to me was just the cherry on top. I mean, the Brewers just came to Los Angeles. They played some really good baseball despite being short a lot of guys. And we talk a lot about their pitching because, rightfully so, it's some of the best in the league. But I mean, 22-0. This is the perfect screen grab for the game. And you know who I felt bad for ultimately? The poor Mariners social media person that had to post the final score. I mean, that's just one where you post and you're out for the day. Get me to the car. See ya.
Wait a second. I'm now realizing that one of my best friends, who is my college catcher, who grew up in Seattle and lives in Milwaukee with his wife, every year he and his wife's extended family, it's like 30 of them, go to the Mariners Brewers game whenever the Mariners are in Milwaukee. He wears a Mariners jersey. The rest of them wear Brewers stuff. And I think he was at this game last night. Oh my God. I hope he left early. That is, I will try and get him on the show for Friday to talk about the experience of being a road fan when your team loses 22-0.
Also, this is just the best way to post the final score. Just don't. Just really minimize the 22-0 at the bottom and just all about Logan Gilbert. It's a new day. 10 out of 10.
Logan Gilbert gets the start in tomorrow's game at 4:40 p.m. Here's what I'll say about this. Good teams don't lose 22-0. They don't. They just don't do that. The Brewers would never do that. And frankly, this is like just so embarrassing for everyone around the Mariners, for the players, for the coaches, for the front office. And very exemplary of what has happened to this team this season. And yet, they are still just three games out in the wild card because the American League is a mud puddle of mediocrity. Katie Wu, before we get out of here, is there anything else you'd like to plug? Anything you'd like to get off your chest? Anything you want to say to the thousands, millions of people listening to us right now?
Oh, yes, to the millions of people. No. Jake Mintz, this was great. I know most of our conversations are just messing around in the dugout. But you know, we were close to a four-homer day. That's kind of our thing with Joshua Baez. Really hoped he was going to get there. So we wait. We wait for the four today. And I'm hopeful that happens.
Katie,
maybe Kyle Tucker for today.
Maybe Kyle Tucker. Katie is one of the other very few sociopaths in baseball who not just follow an account called MLBHR, but get notifications on their phone for every single home run that gets hit during the MLB season. I need to know. It is one of the more unhinged things about me. We are now at a point where we no longer get the notifications on the Cespedes Family Barbecue account. I now just do them on my own personal account because Jordan was kind of sick of it and done with it. Katie Wu is not done with it or sick of it. And we always talk about how it reads. I'll just do an example from last night. Willie Castro, Colorado Rockies, 14, solo, 401 feet. And if a player has hit multiple home runs in the same day, it will say two today. And so Katie and I will frequently send three todays back and forth to each other because we're always chasing the elusive four today, or even the five today.
Dream big. You never know.
Katie, where can people find your work?
I'm on The Athletic, Dodgers, baseball at large, Twitter for really lame hot takes and bad jokes that no one laughs at except for me, at Katie J. Wu on Instagram. I think that one's different. I think that's Kath J. Wu. I don't believe in consistency. Jake Mintz, this was so much fun. Thank you for having me.
If you really want to find Katie Wu, you can find her. Thank you to Andrew Hartz for producing. For those of you who dearly miss Jordan Schusterman, good news. He will be back on Friday. I will say, Jordan does not know about the Seattle Mariners, his Seattle Mariners losing 23-0, because he has turned his phone off. He has undownloaded all of the baseball-related apps, so he is somewhere in the wilderness in Maine living a much happier life. We will talk to all you folks on Friday. For now, adios.